You're listening to the Wordslinger Podcast, episode 87, Learning to Breathe with Kelly Kittle.
Writing a book. It can be the best way to build or grow your business, or to simply tell the story that you wish to tell. Learn how to write your book in 30 days or less. Pick up 30-day author today from Amazon, Apple iBooks, or other online retailers.
It's the Word Slinger Podcast, where story matters. Build your brand, write your book, redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours? Now, here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
Word Slinger. I love that. I had that done a couple of years ago now, and in that time, I've heard people kind of change the way they approach their shows. Some people have gone with all new intros, all new theme music. I've watched other shows sort of evolve from where they started, and I think about it every now and then. I wonder if I should update things, right? But every time I start this show, I literally listen to that intro, and it just gets me into Wordslinger mode. Like, I'm suddenly a podcaster once I hear that theme song. So you should let me know if you like it. I'd love to hear feedback on any aspect of the show. But if you're digging it, why not contact me at wordslingerpodcast.com? Let me know. I would love to hear, because I think it's kind of quirky. I get comments from people about it. But anyway, that's not what the episode's about. Today, we're actually talking to somebody, and this is an interesting episode because of the nature of this guest, you know, the things she's done. You may enjoy this quite a bit. This is Kelly Kittle. She's an author, but she was also formerly a fish biologist, which I just find fascinating. A lot to learn in that. But she's also, she had quite a few tragedies in her life, including the loss of some children. And I am also fascinated by the way she handled that. There's something about human spirit and it, the way, you know, the resiliency of it and the way we can turn tragedy into something positive. And that's exactly what Kelly has done with her life and career. And, you know, she works the field that she's been in for a large chunk of her career. It's something I do find fascinating, even though I'm going to put this out there. I don't actually have a fear of the ocean. I just know that everything in the ocean is trying to kill me. And so I don't want to give it the opportunity. So, you know, I've gone swimming in the ocean. I've been on multiple coasts. So, you know, there is a beauty there. I get it. I've never been the guy who likes to be on the beach, though. It's just not my thing. I like mountains and lakes and streams. You know, I like hikes in the woods. That's my kind of getting in touch with nature. And that's what I think of whenever that phrase comes up, by the way. So that's a topic of conversation in this as well. Because, so, you know, Kelly's a champion swimmer. So, you know, go for that. I mean, that's cool. And that's great exercise, by the way. So, speaking of exercise, in the interest of accountability, I announced on Facebook this past week that I am... I did this last week. I've gone through a lifestyle change when it comes to the way I approach food and exercise. And, you know, I've been a pretty hefty guy for quite a while now. Before my wife, after I got the pacemaker, and if you don't know that story, the short version is I had a birth defect in my heart that went undiagnosed until I was around 38 years old. So there's that. So up until that point, though, I'd gotten kind of really heavy and out of shape. Even though I used to be in great shape, I used to run, I used to exercise. So my life changed quite a bit, and I was starting to get depressed and that sort of thing. After the pacemaker, life picked up for me again, but it was difficult to shift gears and get back into shape. And I did lose quite a bit of weight. I lost about 40 pounds after the pacemaker, and I started a diet and exercise regimen. But when we bought our house, I let all that slide, and eventually, it didn't take long, but within a year or two, I was right back up to like 270 pounds. So a heavy guy. And, you know, I joke and, you know, people say nice things every now and then, like, you know, you carry it well. You don't really look 270. And yeah, okay, thanks. I appreciate that. It does make me feel a little better. But on the whole, I know that I'm way oversized. I look at pictures of myself and realize that, you know, not only am I fat, I mean, that's bad enough. And I'm not afraid of the word fat, by the way. I was fat. I have been fat. And I'm owning up to that. But I am also unhappy about it. Like, I'm there are moments. We were watching a whole series of videos, family videos, over the weekend. And in all of them, I mean, I'm there. I'm having a good time. In the shots where I'm actually thinner, I'm much happier, though. I'm less grumpy. I'm less, withdrawn. And I'm I am an introvert by nature, but I'm a adjusted introvert. I'm a high functioning introvert. So, and I do enjoy talking to people and having a good time and being with family, especially. So watching myself in those videos, the realization eventually hit me that I was not as happy as I could be. And, and part of that, it's less to do with the weight, I will say, and more to do with the fact that I was not disciplined about that portion of my life. And I've come to realize this about myself. It's taken me 40 plus years to realize it, but I'm someone who both needs and values discipline in every aspect of his life. And I've let certain parts of my life slide because they became difficult, you know. So here's what I've been doing. I've been tracking everything. To date, in the past 2 weeks, I've dropped about 10 pounds, which is celebration worthy, I think. And beyond that, I'm changing my relationship with food and exercise. I've got, you know, Minnie, our dog. We now have her. I take her out for walks regularly throughout the day. I have a system for encouraging myself to eat more vegetables, which is something I like vegetables, and so I don't know why this was ever a thing, but I didn't eat a ton of vegetables. Raw nuts, fruits, things like that, things that are healthier for me don't count against me in my little plan. But I log every calorie other than that. It's a long story. But anyway, tracking food has always helped me. I guess it because it keeps it top of mind. It's always helped me. So, again, not the topic of the episode, but I wanted to put it out there. From an accountability standpoint, I guess, but also to encourage anybody, if you are also struggling with this sort of thing, your lifestyle, not your weight, your lifestyle, weight is a byproduct of lifestyle. And so if you're struggling with that, feel free to reach out to me. We can be buddies. We can encourage each other. I want to help as much as I can, and this is one way to do that. So anyway, we're 8 minutes in, and I want to go ahead and get to our guest, because she is wonderful. You'll love listening to Kelly, and stick around afterwards, and we'll do a quick wrap-up. But enjoy this interview with Kelly Kittle. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. And today I'm sitting with Kelly Kittle. Rhymes with little. It's not spelled that way, though. We went through that entire conversation before the call, but it is a lovely name, Kelly. And she is the author of Breathe, a memoir of motherhood, grief, and family conflict, something I think all of us might be a little familiar with in one respect or another. I think most of us have mothers here. But Kelly is also formerly known as a fish biologist, something I want to talk about. She currently lives in Rhode Island with her husband and her three of their five living children, but her favorite writing space is in yurts on the coast of Oregon. Okay, my first question, by the way, because I actually looked up yurts because a friend of mine wants mm-hmm. to have like a fleet of them and sort of use them as like a bed and breakfast kind of thing. But what exactly is a yurt?
So a yurt is a round tent. Basically, it's glamping. It's glorified camping. But it's what the Mongolian yak herders live in, and I often say nomadic yak herders, but then my children tell me that all yak herders are nomadic, so I was being redundant. But anyway, they're round tent-like structures. You build them up on a platform. We built ours. My husband built ours with our help, and we basically have like two yurts put together with a stick-built structure in the center that has a bathroom and a mudroom and whatnot.
Interesting.
Now you're so not, it's like glorified camping, basically.
You're not living in that full time, though. That's just your riding space, or is it full time living?
Well, I live in Rhode Island, and our yurts are in Oregon.
Okay.
So we did live in them full time for 2 years.
I put that together.
Yeah, so they're 3,000 miles away. Otherwise, I'd pop in and write in them every single day if I could. I'm missing them right now. But no, we did live in them for 2 years, and it was fabulous. It's like living. It's like indoor outdoor living. You know, you hear elk bugle and cougars scream and owls and everything. It was really nice.
Yeah, that's kind of part of what Kara and I are moving toward in our lives. My wife and I, of course, we're going to be doing it very glorified, over glorified camping, I guess, in the RV. But I mean, we want to get out there and connect with nature every now and then, as long as it doesn't get on us.
Yeah, and part of the reason we moved to the yurts was to make our footprint a little bit smaller. I had started, there was a whole movement years ago, Step It Up, to reduce carbon emissions that Bill McKibben had started. And I had a group here in Rhode Island and whatnot, and we did all kinds of stuff. And eventually you figure, you kind of have to put your money where your mouth is, or your mouth where your money is. And so we kind of wanted to try something a lot simpler than the 3,000 square foot house I'm sitting in right now.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous. It really was. But it also means that you have a lot of things in storage. I'd like to say we just got rid of it all, but it's not true.
Yeah. It's
maybe someday.
I know. And it's an ongoing battle because, we're continuously downsizing, it seems like. We're moving into the RV in October, which means we have to get rid of a bunch of stuff and or cram it into a storage unit. And since we don't want to pay, $several hundred a month, it'd be nice to get rid of everything. But
I do. And unfortunately, with five kids, you have all their, you can't get rid of everything. You have photo albums and their school records and the whole family history kind of stuff that you don't want to really get rid of. So, I mean, just that stuff alone takes up a lot of space.
So that's been your
talk,
everyone.
But yay, good for you. Hey, and you better come to Rhode Island.
Oh, well, Rhode Island is definitely on the map. I mean, that's one of the places. Our plan is to kind of do the sort of snowbirding thing in a way and kind of come up that way once spring hits and things have thawed out and, we don't have to worry about snow as much. But, that's kind of in the works. We'll get there. We'll definitely be there.
Good.
And then I'm going to go to Oregon.
And you're welcome to go to the yurts.
Yeah.
The yurts are on the coast of Oregon, so let me know.
That would be very cool, actually. I've only seen pictures of yurts online, so I'd like to actually see one, like experience one.
If you go on my website, you can see them.
All right, I'm there. We're there. All right, and that website, I'm going to put that website in the show notes, everyone. So you just hold on. You go check that out later. All right, so that's awesome, and I think we could probably fill an entire half hour with yurt talk.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that. But you're an author, and I like to talk immediately about the author's work, because I think that's probably the thing that's closest to your heart right now. So tell me a little about Breathe.
So Breathe, I wrote, it came out 2 years ago, so it's been out for a couple of years. But basically, it's the story of losing two of our children 9 months apart. Our fourth child, Noah, was run over when he was 15 months old by my then 16-year-old niece in my in-laws' driveway on the coast of Oregon. And I got pregnant right away, which was really shocking to me because I was so sick with grief.
Yeah.
And that baby did help us, for the next 9 months get through all those terrible firsts after losing Noah and whatnot. But then, unfortunately, I had a stillbirth. That was Jonah. He was our fifth child. And he was, I abrupted, which means your placenta lets go suddenly and completely. Mm-hmm. And so I almost died, and he did die. And so we buried two babies in the space of 9 months. So it's the story of that. That turned out to be medical malpractice, and there was a lawsuit that the book ends with. But it's also the story of this incredible family conflict that ensued, which I'm sorry is reality. But yeah. Unfortunately, people don't always deal with things the way you think they will or the way they should.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, those are horrible stories, by the way, and I don't want to make light of them or anything. I mean, I know that is heavy to go through. I have not gone through that particular type of trauma in my life, but I can relate in some ways. But so that I guess that informed the book. I mean, but that's not what are some of the themes and concepts you're exploring throughout the book?
So I grew up surrounded by big, huge families in New England. We live on an island, Aquidneck Island, which is the original Rhode Island, and everybody was Catholic. And so having 7 or 8 kids was the norm. And our family only had 4.
Okay.
And I always thought that was a small family. So my dream in life was to have a big, huge family, like all my friends. And so this is the story of a woman who is who has that dream and is trying to achieve it. Ultimately, I'm also, my husband and I met in the Peace Corps in mm-hmm. Jamaica. So I'm from the coast of Rhode Island. He's from the coast of Oregon. I grew up in a Mayflower, you know, history is everything kind of family, and family is the most important thing. He grew up in a West Coast logging family as the youngest of 8 kids. So perfect. I was like, here's my big family dream. Let's go.
Yeah.
So it is that story as well. Unfortunately, what ended up happening was when we filed that lawsuit for Jonah, my sister-in-law, the mother of my niece who ran over our son, testified against us, which was basically unheard of by any attorney that we talked to. They said usually family is either supportive or they don't get involved. So that was sort of the final nail in the coffin of our family. And like I said, Andy was the youngest of 8, so he lost not only his 2 children, but a lot of his family members as well. And so I also had to redefine what family meant for me.
Yeah.
I was always raised that, you know, you grant lots of families different. You don't think, do I like my aunt?
Right.
You know,
right.
It is your aunt, and you don't think about things like that, and you would never, you know, be rude or inconsiderate to anyone in your family. So I really, my daughter is a forester, and she taught me that trees self-prune, and we're tree farmers. We have quite a bit of trees that we grow out west property.
Hmm.
And so she taught me that trees self-prune, meaning they cut off the nutrients to branches that are no longer healthy or serving the needs of the whole. And so that became my analogy for our family tree. Basically, we had to cut the nutrients off to cut off some of the limbs, sadly.
Yeah.
So a couple things there, you know, having the dream of my big family as well as redefining what family meant.
Yeah.
Those are both big themes in this book.
I find that particularly interesting because of my, like, very convoluted family tree, which is actually kind of like more of a sort of grafted family orchard because of the way things shaped up. But I very much sort of buy into that idea of the self-pruning tree idea, basically, because I've got plenty of family members that fell off. And I actually count... a lot of my very close friends are family to me. So I think family is sort of one of those things that, you know, the definition can be a little flexible.
Yeah, amen. And the blood doesn't necessarily have to run in shared blood in your veins.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting. It's not, you know, I had to write this book because if it wasn't my life, I never would have believed it. I just never would have believed that people would behave this way. And so at its heart, it's just a really incredible story. Most people tell me they read it in 1 or 2 days because they can't put it down. They have to find out what happens.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I was in a writing group with nonfiction writers, so it had to pass muster.
Yeah.
it had to be a page turner, and the plot had to be solid, and character development and all that kind of stuff. So it's not a group for bereaved parents. It's a book for bereaved parents. It's a book for just anybody who's interested in a really wild story.
Yeah. And that's I think, by the way, I prefer books like that. Like, I've never been a big fan of the I guess, preaching to me book. I know that people have gone through some things and they can give me advice. I'd rather hear the story and draw my own conclusions.
Exactly. Exactly. And people get all kinds of, you know, you read to inform your life, right?
Right.
So people, you read from where you're at, and you take from these stories what you will, what you need, and what is valid in your life. So, you know, you absolutely write with the reader in mind. You don't write these things for yourself. And I could, you know, I couldn't even say, like, oh, here's how we got through that, you know, and give you a 10-step guide or something like that.
Yeah, I'm actually often very suspicious of books that tell me the step-by-step for getting through something like grief.
Yeah, you know, it's for everyone.
Exactly. And I've had, at different times in my life, I've had grief that was easier to get over than, you know, than other forms of grief. So I think it is not just different from person to person, but different from event to event.
And also where you're at in your life and what else is happening.
Right.
Right? Yeah, so I had 13 pregnancies, and I have 5 living children.
Wow.
So losing babies, yeah, I know. Losing babies is something. I was very stubborn in my quest to have a large family.
Yeah, you were.
I'm Irish. Anyway, so I was looking on your website about butterflies and Steve Jobs and listening to your voice, and that is something I always encourage women to do. I mean, only you know your own heart. And I was not done having babies until that last baby, my daughter Bella, who's 12 now, who I call the exclamation point at the end of our family. And she's the epilogue in my book. The book is structured in 3 parts. It's the book of Noah, the book of Jonah, and the book of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a prologue called the book of Kelly and an epilogue called the book of Bella, happily. But, you know, nobody wanted to hear that I was pregnant for probably the last 5 or 6 pregnancies I had, probably since I almost died with Jonah even. But I wish women were given more encouragement to listen to themselves in these matters, because only you know your own heart and only you know what you're going to be able to live with for the rest of your life. And sometimes you're just not done, even though everybody thinks you should be. And sometimes you're done before you start, and that's cool too.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just, everybody is different in these regards, and these are huge decisions. So,
Yeah.
So I liked what you wrote about that, about listening to your voice, quoting Steve Jobs.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's nice to be read.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you know, so my wife and I, we actually can't have children, and adoption has been something we've talked about for quite a while, but I think one of the things... And work with me here, because I'm coming around to an idea here. But it's become obvious to my wife and I that, at least for the time being, children were not a priority in our life. Because, when it wasn't the easy choice, like when we weren't able to just have kids, we didn't immediately go out and start looking for alternatives, right? So I think.
Yeah.
There's something he said, like, I'm always astonished. Like, I never really thought about it. I'm always astonished when I meet people who had the dream that you had, which is, I want to have a huge family, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that growing up, so it never occurred to me to even think about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, having even 4 kids in the family was more than I had in my family, so.
Yeah, right. It was just you and your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? I read.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you did read up. Wow.
Yeah, of course. I did my homework. I wanted to know who I was talking to, Kevin.
Oh, exactly.
Kevin.
Yeah.
But, I have good friends who write a blog called Why No Kids.
Yeah.
And they're childless by choice, and that's totally cool. I mean, hello, I am a fish biologist and an environmentalist, and we way exceeded our caring capacity by having just 5 living children, never mind the 7 that we actually had.
Right.
So I appreciate people who aren't having children, because I had more than my share. But I do expect my kids to change the world, so that's my caveat. They have a lot of work to do to make the world a better place. But one of my favorite audiences who read my book are people who don't have kids.
Yeah.
And even men who read my book are my favorite, because, you know, they wouldn't be my most obvious reader.
Yeah.
And I love when they read it and review it and tell me what they got out of it. And my friend who has the blog said, you know, now she understands a lot more about what it is like to have a child,
right,
to give birth, all that kind of thing. I think that's all fabulous.
See, that's kind of where I was going. Like, it's like living vicariously.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what a story is, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
It takes you out of your everyday thing. I wanted to talk a little bit about the power of story.
Yeah.
Because it's been so amazing to me, like, the journey since this book has come out. And they say that, writing your story makes it two-dimensional.
Yeah.
And reading makes it three. And it's just amazing to me, like, every time I sit and do a reading and read the voices of people in this book who are dead, like my mother-in-law and my mother, and it, like, brings them right back into the room, right?
Right.
That is the most amazing thing to me. But beyond that, like, people always say, oh, writing this book must have been so hard. And I'm like, no, on the contrary, writing this book was like spending time with my kids, with Noah and Jonah, again, right? And who doesn't want to spend more time with their children, whether they're living or dead?
Yeah.
And a lot of days I would just look up from my keyboard and expect to see Noah come toddling across the floor to me. But before this book came out, they died 18 and 19 years ago, and all anybody really knew about them was that they died. Like,
right,
that was the most defining characteristic of their little lives, right? And then they read this book, and they meet them for the first time, and they hold them in their hearts, and they miss them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like, thousands of people now who know their story and who miss these boys.
Yeah.
And I just, that's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible to me.
That is. You know, that, when you were saying that, it reminded, there was a, did you ever read Into the Wild?
Yes, Candless. I did.
I can't remember the kid's first name, but John Krakauer, I think, wrote that book. And that was one of the thoughts I had reading that book, was that this kid was someone we would never know.
Right.
And probably, there's every possibility we may have passed him, you know, in his journey, just and never realized who he was, never would have realized who he was. But because of this book, now we know him, you know.
Right.
He was someone who would have disappeared in history and never been known. So, yeah, I think I see exactly what you mean there. And it is, that's actually kind of an honor for the reader then. I mean, we're being invited into your life. We get to share a very rich part of your life, which is, that's something to feel good about.
That's amazing to me. And some people would stop. They'd say, you know what, I'm going to stop right here because Noah's still with us.
Yeah.
And I know he's, and because it's nonfiction, you don't start with the change like you do with fiction, right? So I couldn't just drop you into Noah's death. So there's like six chapters, I think, or seven, I stink with numbers, leading up to him. And like, people actually wrote and said, I'm just going to stop right here because I just want to hold him in my heart for a little while. I know he's only going to be here for another chapter or so.
Yeah.
And that's so cool, right? That's just really, really powerful stuff. And so I also speak a lot about miscarriage and stillbirth because these are silent deaths for the most part. They're very personal for a mom. And a lot of them are just sort of swept under the rug, these little tiny lives. But their loss is all the same, and you feel it, trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is different. I'm not going to say you feel it the same as anything. You feel it. And so I do always encourage women to share what I call their war stories. Share these stories. Share the stories of your disappointments as well as your successes, and especially about these kind of little lives and these subjects that are largely taboo in our society and aren't talked about, right?
Right, right.
And I think, because you know what happens, Kevin? When we don't share these things, when you find yourself going through them, you think, why me?
Yeah.
Why am I the only one having this kind of, everybody on Facebook has a perfect life except for me. What did I do wrong? You know, so we become very isolated because we think we're the only ones.
Yeah. Yeah,
so right, across the board, whatever your topic is, whether it's we're trying to have children and we can't, or we were abused by our dad, or, you know, there's all kinds of things out there, all kinds of different topics.
Yeah.
That people are just finally starting to kind of open up and share, and that's so important.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree with that. I mean, there's
we have to shatter the silence.
We have a tendency to think that we're the only ones who go through what we go through. And so we don't share because we think there's not going to be any interest or no one can relate or, you know, whatever. And then there are
Who, we're ashamed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and that, I just came from a grief conference where I do a bit of speaking, grief speaking. But that's what I always say. Like, you know, people don't, the number one feeling that bereaved parents have, regardless of how their child has died, is shame and and guilt.
Yeah.
Guilt. We feel guilty because we failed to protect our child.
Right.
Whether it was from cancer or a car accident or a drug overdose, what doesn't matter. Like, it's just the way life is. Yeah. We feel responsible.
Yeah. 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 I understand that. Like, I feel that, but that's hard to articulate because it's, we do tend to take the blame, I guess, even though there's no, we had no power over that situation.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's not always, you know, an intelligent thought. It's a feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just a feeling. You feel guilty.
Yeah.
You feel ashamed.
Yeah.
Right? You don't want to share that you've failed. And I believe in our society, we need to do a much better job of sharing our failures as well as our successes. The glowing Christmas letters, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The Facebook profiles, the,
All of it. Yeah. No one's sharing their shit. They're just sharing all the good stuff.
Right. We're creating this, like, LL Bean catalog of our lives where everything is perfect.
LL Bean catalog, yeah. Everyone's in plaid.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that's what I'm going for. That's why every time you see a picture of me, I'm in basically plaid.
You are. I'm looking at you right now in a plaid shirt.
Exactly.
Yeah, but, I hope LL Bean picks up on that.
Yeah, no kidding, guys. LL Bean, come on. Sponsor the Wordslinger podcast.
Okay.
Could use some new threads. All right. I wanted to hit on this briefly because you bring it up, and it's a theme on your website too, but this whole half fish, half author. I wanted to ask you about it. Like, what's the story behind you being a marine biologist? How'd that happen?
I'm a fish biologist. Yeah.
Fish biologist.
Because I grew up on an island, I said, surrounded by ocean here in Rhode Island. And so I've been on or around or in the ocean my whole life in one way or another. I've lived in a lot of other places, but I've never lived far from the ocean. And I'm a distance ocean swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
So the ocean is where I go to find my peace and my solace. And it's where I take my grief and all the grief stories I hear from other people. I take it to the ocean and swim for them as well as swimming for myself. And that's just, you know, what I get the most enjoyment out of, I guess. Yeah. I swim every day in the ocean.
Yeah, I'm on record in many places as saying that I actively avoid the ocean because everything in the ocean is trying to kill me. And so I admire your bravery.
Well, you have to be brave and do hard things. You know what? Wait, on that topic, I always say, like, if you've buried your child, you've already done the hardest thing there is to do in life.
I could see that, yeah.
Right? And it whatever it is you have in mind for the rest of your life, go and do it, man. Because nothing is ever going to be harder than that. So swimming in the ocean is way easier, trust me, than burying your child. And every day is different. It's just amazing to me. I swim with a group of people, and there's always a certain number of us, whatever. But, like, today it was super choppy and rough. There was this huge, like, wind chop that had developed. And so sometimes you'd put your arm out in front of you and think you were going to pull on air, and instead you'd go, like, right through a wave.
Yeah.
Like, so even literally, like, you know, you think you're going to hit air and you hit water. And every day it's just an adventure.
Yeah.
And I swim with a mask and snorkel, so I can tell you firsthand that we don't see anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll maybe a jellyfish every now and again, but really, what people think we see and what we actually see are completely different things.
There's not
schools. Sadly, maybe there used to be, but there's not like schools of fish.
I don't know when I developed this aversion to the ocean. I don't know when, because I used to be fine with it. Like, let's go. Let's hit the beach. Let's go swimming. Let's go surfing, you know. And then somewhere mm-hmm. along the way, I'm like, yep, sharks. Yeah, I'm out. Jellyfish.
I just met this amazing woman who has swam the coast of Costa Rica 7 times.
Wow.
And she was swimming there. We lived in Costa Rica, and I was writing Breathe in 2008 when we lived there, and this woman was swimming on by. And she said she pets sharks.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they're not, usually if they bite you, it's an act. They didn't mean to, right? They thought you were a seal or something.
Accidents happen.
I've never, ever seen one, and I've logged, I don't even know how many hours in the ocean.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Another part of that, though, is breathing. Like, it's so the key to swimming is breathing.
Yeah.
If you have a relaxed breath, and you can just swim forever. And one of the reasons my book is named Breathe is because, one of the defining things that all three of my boys experienced was they couldn't breathe, right?
Yeah.
And then I forgot how to breathe. I stopped breathing. One of the hardest things to do when you're bereaved is to breathe, because you're storing all that pain in your cells and deep within your belly and your solar plexus or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And so you stop breathing into it because it just hurts too much.
Yeah.
And so slowly, like, I credit yoga with saving my life, but I had to learn to breathe into that pain in order to release it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, swimming is like that and yoga is like that, but it's all about breathing, right? Which is so important, and a lot of us forget how to breathe. The older we get, the more we forget how to breathe deeply.
Yeah. I can attest to that. I am one of those people that lets the whole ocean of life kind of overwhelm them too. So, you know, I don't take
What do you
time.
Do to get rid of it?
I write. That's my form of breathing. That's my
I know,
form
but
of
you know as well as I do, Kevin, writing is a killer.
Yeah.
Sitting in your chair, oh my gosh, I sit sometimes until I hurt.
That is true.
I physically hurt.
I need to find activities that, that mm-hmm. I can get into. You know what my problem is? It's not that I wouldn't go do things. I enjoy biking. I enjoy walking. You know, I don't mind getting out and getting active. The problem for me is that now I'm not writing, and so I get this huge like anxiety guilt trip.
Mm.
And it's not right, and it shouldn't be that way, but that's what happens. So that's
when you're not writing. But I don't know about you, but I mean, I love to write, and so I can literally sit. I have a little drawing that a friend did for me. I said, you know, someday I am just going to crawl into my laptop and close the lid.
Right.
And you'll never see me again, because that's how I feel, right? I get completely lost in this world of my computer screen, and I sit until I am, you know, literally about to wet my pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't eat. I won't drink. I'll just sit here all day and write if I could.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I really would.
And it's even worse when you're like, you know, when you factor in like social media and I'm in Slack with several people that I communicate with, and I'm on Skype. And so I do the podcast, you know, and by the time it's all said and done, you know, I think the reason I feel guilty if I walk away is because I know there's 1,000 things that I could be doing, and not all of them are all that important.
No, but we attach importance to them.
Yeah, we make them too important.
But yeah, I mean, it kills our bodies. We really do have to get up and move. We have to force ourselves. And for me, like summer, my kids are home now, so I can't just sit. I know summer is unproductive, and I just have to deal with that. When I first started writing my book, it was called Nap Time, because that was the only time I could find to write. And, I mean, moms with small kids, I don't even know how they write. They must either do it in the middle of the night or really, really early in the morning, but then I would think they'd be exhausted. So my hat's off to moms like that. Because
yeah, no kidding.
I couldn't do it until my last baby was napping, literally, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why I've come late in life to being an author, which I absolutely love doing. So I have stopped. Most of my fish biology work was out west.
Yeah.
I worked on multi-million salmon restoration projects, basically.
Hmm.
So saving the salmon kind of stuff. And there's not a lot of that, sadly, in the east, that kind of work, in
right.
other words. So it's harder for me to find good employment here.
Yeah.
So I've been slowly transforming myself into an author instead, which I absolutely love, but it doesn't really pay, does it?
No, well, it can.
Not yet. Not yet, but I'm working that.
I was thinking about becoming a fish biologist, so I'm glad you talked me out of that.
Oh, no, it's a great job. I get to live out west.
Yeah, that's the thing,
though. I don't know how it is in Texas.
Like, I don't know how successful I'll be at it when I don't want to go in the ocean.
Well, you don't have to go in the ocean.
No, I know.
To be a fish biologist. So I worked as a, the beginning of my fish biology career was, I worked as a foreign fisheries observer in the Bering Sea on board a Japanese, what's called a mothership, a factory ship. So it was four American women and 300 Japanese men.
Oh, wow.
I know, right?
Okay.
But so that was a great adventure.
They, you know, you were among some of the most repressed men on the planet.
No, they're not. You'd be so surprised.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. That's what I thought.
They're not living up to their stereotypes? That is shocking.
No, they're totally lecherous, and they drink a lot and have a good time. I mean, these are fishermen. I don't know.
Well,
maybe
that's true.
They're not all like that. But.
No, I think that fishermen are their own nationality, though. Like, it doesn't matter what region you're from. Like, you know, fishermen all act the same. Every fisherman I've ever known acts essentially the same.
So, no, I was surprised, though. Yeah, they definitely blew the stereotype of the polite Japanese.
Yeah.
That I had in mind, anyway.
That's right.
But they were wonderful. I mean, we were in the front of the ship with all the officers. We weren't in the back with all the hard workers, workers, I guess, or whatever. So I don't know how it would have probably been very different. We dined in the officers' quarters, and they treated us very, very well.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
Mm-hmm. But it was hard work.
So we've passed our minute mark, and I... Which is unfortunate because I'm enjoying our conversation. And
I know.
Now I want to talk about fish more. Where can people find you online? We talked about this briefly.
I have a website, www.kellykittel.com.
Okay.
K-I-T-T-E-L, right? And then, of course, I'm on Twitter and Facebook and all those other great places. I love when people friend me.
Yeah. So okay.
Please do. And
I haven't friended you yet, have I? I haven't jumped on and...
No,
like
you're going to
friend
me.
Twitter friended you, and we'll do that. Mm-hmm. You'll see me in a few minutes.
That sounds good. But before we go, I love the name of your thing, Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
The name of your podcast here. And so I wanted to ask you if you have a favorite word.
You know, it changes frequently, so I don't think I have like an overriding favorite word. The first word that popped in my mind when you said that was troglodyte.
Troglodyte?
Yeah.
I love that. I don't remember where this came from, but it's like my latest question for people because I think it's so interesting. A, it's interesting to hear if people do have a word, but B, it's just interesting if people do have a word. Right?
It is. I could see that because someone's favorite word I think says a lot about them personally. So you can learn a lot about their personality, and that word is just something interesting to say for me. Like it's not, I mean, the meaning is interesting also, but I mean it's more like it's a fun word to say.
Fun to say, like I like serendipity and anemone. I think those are fun to say.
Anemone is a tough word for me.
I love anemone, but also it's fun to hear. Also, like you just said, like is it your favorite because you love saying it, or because you love the meaning, or
right.
You know what I mean? It's such an interesting question. I asked my 12-year-old, and right away she said ziggurat.
Oh, ziggurat's a good word.
Right, just right off the top of her head. I mean, I'm like agonizing months later. What's my favorite word?
See, I couldn't pick a favorite, but I will say though that one of the things that I like in Canada, you know, instead of A to Z, it's A to Z, and things like that are fascinating to me. Like I just really like that.
I find in general, like a lot of other languages have better words for saying certain things and expressing certain emotions than we do, and I often resort to those.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, good.
That's a fun question. I'm glad you asked.
I know. It's a really fun question, right? It's a good party question. I know you go to a lot of parties, so pull that one out.
I'm
going to
start doing
that.
But then people are going to start expecting it from me, though, so I'll have to have a few I can throw in and mix things up.
Oh, there you go. So. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you.
We finally connected. Yeah.
Yes, and for everyone listening out there in listener land, stick around. You'll hear some cool stuff. But you can definitely find links to Kelly's websites, her author page, all kinds of stuff in the show notes. Kelly, I do appreciate you being on. Let's keep in touch so we can, I want to keep track of what you're doing.
Yeah, my next book is a travel memoir about living in Costa Rica.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So we'll have to chat about that. That'll be something really
by
fun.
By any chance, why did my brain just blank out? This would have been my favorite word. Tsunamis or anything like that?
We actually were living on the beach there when that tsunami, the Japanese horrible earthquake, the Fukushima, whatever it was called, earthquake hit. And so we were on tsunami alert for that, but that was, that's the only time.
Man, I watched an entire series of videos about that, and it was just mind-boggling. But we can go, I don't want to get into that.
Next time.
So, okay. All right, thanks everybody. Stick around for the wrap-up. Thank you again, Kelly, for being on the show, and everyone else, we'll see you after.
Great.
So that was my interview with Kelly. I hope you enjoyed that. Hope you got a lot out of it. One of the things that I love about this show is being able to take some inspiration away with me, with every single guest. And, sometimes I go back and re-listen to episodes, and I'm sometimes surprised by the insights that come out of them that I may or may not have noticed the first time around. So it's actually quite nice. In the interest of wrapping up, some housekeeping I would appreciate greatly if you would go onto iTunes and find the show and rate and rank it there. You can give it 5 stars if you like. I appreciate that. The best way to do that, by the way, is to go into iTunes and just search the word Wordslinger. You might throw in my last name too, Tumlinson. That might help. But if you search Wordslinger or Wordslinger Podcast, we'll probably take you directly to the podcast on iTunes. And then there's a little button there, a little tab. If you scroll down just a bit, you'll see a little tab where you can click on reviews and you can write and post a review. Those help me to branch out, to increase my discoverability so people can find the show and get a lot out of it. If you if you're a regular listener, you know this, but I mean, new listeners may not realize that one of the things I focus on. This is not an author podcast, although I talk to a great many authors. What it is a story podcast. This is all about finding the story in our everyday lives and our everyday careers. I love to talk to people who are just sort of outside the scope of what you normally hear on shows like this, so that we can learn from it. If you're an author tuning in, here's how this show benefits you. This is how I feel the show benefits you. But you get to hear the perspective of someone you may not have checked out or investigated before, right? Now, if you're a fiction author, that's pretty valuable, because having this library of characters and information and stories to draw upon can be very useful. I've already used some things I've learned from this show in my books, especially the Dan Kotler books. So that's what I want this to be for people. I want this to be that kind of resource. I want it to be an inspiration in your life for change and that sort of thing, for improvement. I also want it to be a source of information and material that you can use in myriad ways. And here's what I'd like. I want you to review the show. I definitely do. But I would love for you to also email me, contact me at wordslingerpodcast.com, and let me know what you think of the show, but also tell me how you're using the information. I would love to hear that, because once I know that, then I can also sort of tailor episodes specifically for that use. So let me know how you're using the show, and I appreciate that. Now, we're going to go ahead and wrap up, and I appreciate you being here, sticking out to the end. I would really like those reviews on iTunes, on Stitcher. We're on Google Play now. I appreciate that. And I love hearing from people. I've heard from so many people recently. Now, since I joined the Drafted Digital team as their director of marketing, I get approached a lot by people who are aware of that. And that's great. So I unofficially will say at this point, I've kind of made Drafted Digital a sort of unofficial sponsor of the Wordslinger podcast, just because I mention it so often. If you are an author, first of all, everyone should be an author. I'm just going to put that out there. If you're an entrepreneur at all, you should have a book. And if you are having trouble getting started with a book, if you need direction, feel free to reach out to me at wordslingerpodcast.com. I will gladly and gleefully help you because you definitely need a book. In fact, I've got a guest coming up. I'm interviewing her on the 30th, so it'll be a couple of weeks out from that before you hear the episode. But I'm bringing Honoré Quarter back, who is authoring a book called You Need to Write a Book. I believe that's what it's called. Now, if I got that wrong, Honoré, I apologize. We'll fix it. But the gist there is everybody needs a book. Every entrepreneur, every business person needs a book. Now, if you are an author, well, then you definitely need a book. But but there are things that, if you need some advice or whatever, feel free to hit me up. I'm always happy to. But Draft to Digital offers some really just bomb tools that will help you as an author. If you are an entrepreneur publishing for the first time, you can actually use Draft to Digital to get out to a global marketplace, which is very helpful for you and very helpful for your readers, which are the kind of the point, right? You want to reach the readers with your message. So talk to me about that too. They just recently introduced something. We're calling it Universal Book Links, or UBLs. And what that does is allow you to create one link that lets your readers find your books on every store where it is available online. Find your book where it is available online, every store. Or find your books where they are available online, every store. So that's a pretty useful tool for discovery to get your work out there. So I hope you'll check that out. You can find that at books2read.com. Books2read.com. And definitely check out draft2digital.com. So that you can learn a little more about how that service works. If you've got questions about either one, let me know. Just let me know. You can pop onto the blog there and make comments. You can email the customer support there directly. But here's a little secret just for Wordslinger podcast listeners. You can contact me directly and ask me any question you like about Draft to Digital, and I will answer in one way or another. So feel free to do that. There you go. That's the unofficial Draft to Digital sponsorship of the Wordslinger podcast. I'm the marketing director there, so I get to make that call. So anyway, thanks so much for tuning in and checking this out. I am happy to answer any questions you have at wordslingerpodcast.com. I love each and every one of you. I am not just saying that. I truly do. It is a mandate from God that I do that. I will do it. And I appreciate you tuning in. God bless each and every one of you. I'll talk to you again next week. Wordslinger.